I didn't grow up with politics really at home. And really the most that I got was just the propaganda in high school, which is, I think for a lot of people, it doesn't even seem like propaganda, but just as an introduction to Israeli society, which is one in the same in a lot of ways. And what's, as a young person, what stands kind of at the core of this is military service. It's not a coincidence that they enlist you when you're 18, just barely out of high school. At that age, you just grow up on what they tell you in high school. You don't have enough time to really go out or to think thoroughly about the decision. And they encourage you from a very young age to not just go, because this is, let's say, obvious, but to go for the most, for, let's say, the best service that you can give to the country. And to go for the units that will advance you most in your career after the military. It's seen as an opportunity, not as something that, like, this heavy duty that you need to give, but as an opportunity to be part of society in the best way possible. So already when you're 16, when I was 16, I got an invitation to have an interview with the military, which is the standard. So when you're 16, you go to a military base, you go through a bunch of tests, you go through a bunch of interviews to assess your skills or your intellect. And based on this, they send you a bunch of invitations for different tests, different programs to see whether you fit into different programs of the military. And this is when you're 16, 17, so when you're still a minor. For me, already at that age, I knew that when I got the invitation, I already knew that I don't want to go. But my family at the time, they were really afraid of that possibility. They could not imagine a normal life for me in society without it. It wasn't even a political rejection of the idea, but it was a practical one. It's like, what do you mean you don't want to go to the military? It's like, what are you going to do then if you don't go? Why don't you just choose something that has, you know, no political meaning, like being a photographer or being in administration or anything that doesn't relate directly to the military, as, you know, the stereotype of soldiers fighting, just to do your part and then go on with society as normal. And at the time, I told them also at the base that I don't want to go, and it was for political reasons. And since then, I rejected the many, many letters that I received for different tests and courses. And of course, the people that I went to high school with, they always got these letters and they went. So it was a regular occurrence to miss classes because you were on a test for the military. We would often have soldiers coming into the school to explain about what they do, and to encourage us to go to different units, or to explain to us the different possibilities, the different routes that you would have. You can have your bachelor paid by the military if you do this program. You can do some sort of civil service first. There's all these different options, but at the end of the day, you only have one option when it comes down to it. And when I started talking about this in high school as well, that I don't want to go, then at first it was not even seen as any political statement. It was seen as a sign of that something was wrong with me. I got invitations to go to the counselor because maybe there's something going on at home. Maybe this is like teenage rebellion. Some teachers thought that there was something wrong with me mental health-wise because I didn't want to go to the military. They thought this was like a cry for help because it was so radical and so out of the ordinary. And really my political understanding was through the internet, through reading, you know, not even meeting with people, but all throughout reading what's going on in the West Bank mostly, because this, at least at the time, this was the only thing that you could really see as part of the political discussion still of the very, very far left of the country. But it was still something that was being discussed, the military violence, the settler attacks, like the tip of the surface, I would say. And even without at that time I've never been to the West Bank. I've never had a real human-to-human interaction with a Palestinian. I lived in a Jewish-only neighborhood where the only situation where I would even see Palestinians was at some shopping centers that was between two communities. So it was a really, really segregated kind of way to grow up. There was not really a way to see what was going on the other side. It's not like, it's like a lot of the times people ask me, how can you not see what's going on because it's so close? But it actually could not be further because you never crossed that line. You don't think to yourself, oh, I can just go to this Arab village that's like 20 minutes away. You just don't do it. And you never cross, into the Palestinian areas. They're considered dangerous. So you grow up with this fear of these people and with this ignorance. And unless you really take also the effort to learn about what's going on, you can be so, so ignorant of things that are happening 5 minutes away from where you live.
Wow. So what are the consequences when you don't do the military service? Yeah.
So when I refused, well, because it's not allowed, then I went to jail. It's basically, it's not even recognized as a thing that you can do because the charge that I was put under was refusal of a military order because it's not even it's not even specified because it doesn't exist. Even when I went, because I went to the military base where I was supposed to enlist and, you know, in order to refuse. But the whole process was even so confusing because I was like, I don't know how to refuse. I don't know at which point I should say no. And, you know, we got on the bus and we reached the base. And then after like a small introduction, I tell to the person who's supposed to be my guide, hey, I'm refusing military service. And he was like, no, you can't refuse. So just come with me here. And I try to, okay, I'm actually refusing, like you cannot actually force me. And it took about 40 minutes of back and forth and going to consult with other people around because he's never had this situation. He doesn't know that it exists, this possibility. It took so long that there was even lunchtime before he actually took me to the court, let's say, because it was just seen as really odd, like really just not an option. And this is really how it's seen in the Israeli society at large. And the thing is that when you refuse, especially publicly, and when you don't try to say that it's for personal reasons, me personally, I don't want to go, because this is something, sometimes people do that and they still say, oh, I respect the military, they're doing important work, but me personally, I have some issues and I don't want to go. But when you openly say that it's not just that I don't want to go, I don't think this is a good thing to go, and actually I think that it's a crime to go. I'm doing an injustice if I go. Once you cross this step, it basically makes you completely blocked from the vast majority of society, whether that is career-wise, because a lot of industries are basically the only way that you can get to it is through the military, which is also how the Palestinian population is denied entry to those usually higher paying industries. Even socially, it's I remember up until I was about 21, whenever I met any Israeli person, whether that's in Israel or abroad, always one of the first questions was if I did the military.
And where did you serve?
And where did I serve? And when they realized that I did not do and I was not apologetic for it as well, it was the immediate tone of voice. I remember that when I actually started building a social life outside of the Israeli population, then it suddenly was super shocking because I wasn't feeling like I had to defend. I could be really proud without any kind of argument, like it's a bit like being sane in a mental house, if you use that quotation. Because when you're in Israel and you tell people that you don't do the military, it's in a so crazy and so wrong that you're constantly in defense mode. And this is still to this day. People that refuse, people that are not supporting the military, even to this day, they're if they try to be a part of even the vague sense of mainstream Israeli society, they're boycotted. They have campaigns against them. The amount of hate comments that I received, even from family members and people from my own community, it was in the thousands. I was in jail, so thankfully I didn't really watch it live. but it was in the thousands, and it was very, very extreme to go through that as a young person, and that's the reason also a lot of people don't do it publicly.
So basically every year there are many people who refuse the military, and many of them for religious reasons. Mm-hmm. For women is also easier. You can just marry in the age of 18 and then you don't have to go to the service. Mm-hmm. Or you declare that you are mentally not healthy or so.
Yeah.
But only around 8 to 10 a year amount where people who become conscious objectors. No?
Yeah.
That's the conscious objectors.
Yeah.
And this rate is not changing also now. To know that even despite this genocide that is going, still hundreds are refusing, but to go publicly and to say, I am refusing to serve in the army because of my consciousness,
mm-hmm.
is not changing. And that's a dangerous sign.
Yeah, publicly, I can say that it's very, very difficult. I had a lot of, I would say, mental strength to be able to go through that, because I think if I wasn't as confident, it's a very, very difficult thing to go through. I mean, I had cousins, you know, like, calling my grandma and she talking about me, and mm-hmm. and, you know, the hate that you receive from your surrounding is intense. My family got threats, you know, people tried to push them out of the neighborhood. So it's very, very, very intense. And I was lucky that my family in that process, they also became politically conscious. But a lot of people don't come from those families, and that's why most people who are public about it are people who come from either families that are already politically conscious or families that go through that journey along the way or are open enough to it. But I know some people, there are a few that don't have supportive families, and it's really, really difficult because they go to jail and they have no home to return to. Or they are in a really, really difficult situation because they don't have their own community. And even the politically conscious community in Israel is so, so small that it's not enough of a structure to really support these few people that don't have the support. So it's very difficult to do it publicly. A lot of people I know that refused or avoided service, usually we call it avoiding service. They avoided service in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of different ways to do it. Some easier, some harder. But a lot of those people, they still, even when they talk about it, they try to show that they are still contributing to the Israeli society. So, for example, when I refused, a lot of people told me, "Oh, but you should do civil service instead, to show that you still care about the country that you live in, to show that you're still part of society," as kind of like this way to cover up for, you know, the injustice that you're doing by not going to the military.
So now you said that you were informed by the internet, but what was moving in your heart? Why really from the inner? Why did you refuse? And mm-hmm. what was your journey from then, if you look into the system, mm-hmm. not only from the eyes of rejecting the military service, what's going on there? What is happening? What is Zionism for you? And I mm-hmm. can't complete, but
mm-hmm.
what is this system? And how is it in the inner?
Mm-hmm. I think, interestingly enough, when I refused, I didn't even have a very strong sense of what Zionism was.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time, when I heard the testimonies of what's going on in the West Bank, it was enough for me to, without understanding much of the history or about the context, it was enough to say that this is just not right. And until we solve this issue, then, I mean, there is no point in continuing society as normal. Only after, you know, some years that I had the time to really, you know, learn the full picture, then I realized that it's even bigger than that. And it's the whole idea of Israel, you know, from the very beginning. The idea of building a Jewish state in an area that the majority are not Jewish. you know, there's the common myth that is being told is that on the foundation of Israel, the refugee problem, that basically these people left because either they attacked us or they left from their own will because they didn't want to live in a Jewish state. But then at the same time, they tell you, oh, we cannot in any way let these people come back no matter what, because then their existence itself would destroy the Jewish state from existence. So it already shows you kind of the cognitive dissonance that goes on there, that their existence itself is the problem. It doesn't matter what they do or what they don't, if they resist, if they don't resist. This was also one of the things that was really shocking to me to learn about the Nakba, about the foundation of the country, that I there was a lot of myths that I took so much for granted, because it's, you don't think about it too much. It's seen as like this ancient history. And it seems kind of obvious. Yeah, they just left because they didn't want to be in our country. And then when you find out that so much injustice has happened and that it was planned all along and there was no other way that this country could exist, I think this made me really realize that the problem is not in an occupation of a certain region, but it's about the very concept of the state. That it's about the idea of what citizenship means in Israel, that it's exclusive to one type of person, and it inherently creates this idea that there is a certain type of person that doesn't deserve to live in the country, which as a general rule, regardless of the territory that it is, this is already a flawed idea. It doesn't matter who came first, which group has more, you know, historic or cultural or whatever ties. It doesn't matter. The idea that there is a person that is wrong in a country, that can't exist in a country, that is a danger just by them existing, is already a problem. And for me, this is what Zionism is. There is no way to reform that.
Yeah, as I said it before, I think we are all informed that by now more than 36,000 were killed in Gaza. Now often we say majority are women and children, and just this morning I reflected in another group of how the brutality of this sentence when we say the majority are women and children, which is a fact. But where it is also says in a side comment that it's okay to kill men. And I want, just this morning, it touched me so much after I said it, to be aware of it. Why do we normalize killing men? Why do we, how we became a society that normalized killing at all? So more than 36,000 are murdered in Gaza and still going on. Only in the last 24 hours, more than 220 were murdered in Mukhayim and Sirat. And by this time of the genocide in the West Bank, more than 360 were murdered. 9,000 people were arrested in the West Bank. And thousands of homes of Bedouins whom I come from, the indigenous people of Palestine, their homes and tents and livelihood was destroyed. And this is within the borders of Israel, people like me, in the West Bank and in Gaza. And while all what's happening, 80% of the Israeli society is still okay, encouraging and going on, wanting that the genocide, wanting that the war goes on. And that's a shocking information. Just 2 weeks ago, we were in Palestine for a visit, to visit friends and projects. And it is shocking to be in that place, in that narrative, and to meet Israelis. And you don't know if these are of the 20% or of the 80% that wants your killing. And you said many things that explain why would a society, 80% of the society, seeing all the destruction that the government is making in Gaza, and still go, says, yes, continue the, no, don't make ceasefire, continue. How do you make sense of it? What is your take on this?
I think at the end of the day, it all comes down to propaganda. Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting to see how strong it has been throughout this whole process, just by looking at what Israelis are saying online and what they're saying to each other. There's this very... Yes. There's been a lot of shifting between denial and justification, which has been... This is the Israeli propaganda. It always shifts between those two lines. But especially now, you can really see that... there's a lot of denial of what's going on. There's a lot of circulation of fake information that says that there is no hunger in Gaza, that they're receiving a lot of aid, and that it's all lies to stay in the image of the country or to get more money from Europe or from the US. I think when it comes to the killing, the reporting of what's going on, this is when it comes really shocking, because a lot of the times it's just not reported whatsoever. You don't see anything. At most you see like this phrase that basically is like clashes between forces in this and this area. Even for example, the massacre that happened in the tent areas not so long ago, which was the photos that I think and the videos that the world saw were so horrific that it's just unimaginable. And then in the Israeli media, they show you just the photos where you see just fire and some, you know, it's dark, you just see some fire and maybe some tents, but you don't see any people. You don't see anything. And most of the photos that are seen on Israeli media is just of destruction. But there's not the pictures of the people getting killed. At most it's of men getting killed, which comes back to your point that the normalization of killing of Palestinian men has been so much since forever that it's just automatically it's justified. So if a Palestinian man was killed, there was for sure a reason why. And I even remember even before this genocide, before this war, there was a killing of an autistic Palestinian man.
Yad al-Halaq.
Exactly. Which was really, it kind of got a lot of attention in Israeli media because it was so undeniable. There was no way to frame him as anything else than a victim. And it got a lot of, people felt so much about it. They felt really, that this was an injustice, this is police brutality. And you can see how, the responses were so different because there was no way to twist what happened. There is no way to frame an autistic man going to his school as anything else than, called murder. And just to think about the fact that if he wasn't autistic, then this murder would be justified by just saying that, oh yeah, he tried to throw a rock or he was a terrorist or he was part of this and that organization. And this would not reach the news. It would already be justified because it would just be so easy, and not only would his family experience the unimaginable grief, but they would also have to face the shame now of being seen as family of terrorists, which has a lot of legal implications, a lot of political implications. This could lead to deportation, to house demolitions, to arrests, and this is something that has been going on for so long that it's a really normalized Israeli people to accept it and to really be in denial that it's happening. And the justification part is really, I think this part is really, it's really, really painful to see the fact that a lot of people who at least claimed in the past to, kind of see both sides or to want to have a peace deal or were for, communication with Palestinian people, that a lot of people now are basically seeing this as a survival war where anything we do that is justified because we are in a survival war, and if we don't do it, then we would be exterminated. And this is the kind of thinking. And this kind of thinking, of course, leads you to justify and commit horrible, horrible things, because no matter what you do, you can do anything, and it's all going to be justified beforehand, just from this perspective. So it doesn't matter. People don't think to seek out what's actually going on, because it doesn't matter, because no matter what we do, it seems justified. So a lot of people, for example, nowadays, they don't seek out the pictures and the videos that are coming from Gaza. And what they're seeing on Israeli news is not even 1% of it, and it's always framed in a certain way. And they're already, I remember even in high school, when there was one war in Gaza that I remember particularly, and this was even before I had my political consciousness, and I remember hearing a lot and reading a lot this idea that if you see photos of dead children, that it's fake, that it's not real, that it's actually pictures from Syria, or it's actually pictures from Yemen, and that there's so much misinformation, and be ready, because if you see pictures of dead children, you should know that it's fake. Mm-hmm. And this I remember as a child, and they already kind of prepare you to, if you do bypass the walls of propaganda, that you're able to already justify and deal with the cognitive dissonance that it causes you to see the horrible things that are committed by your country.
Now, when we are in the notion of propaganda, and this is how it works on the Israeli society, and earlier you spoke about how does propaganda work on others? Mm-hmm. Would you elaborate on this?
Yeah. So I really started thinking about this when I got, especially since this recent war started, I got a lot of responses from, especially from Europeans, that really struggle to understand how the Israeli society is justifying all of this and is really, you know, going along with this and even cheering this on. They really, really couldn't understand how is it possible to see so much death, so much destruction, so much horror, and have a whole population just completely be blind to it. And that it's so close, you know, Gaza and Tel Aviv are, you know, barely an hour away, and it's completely parallel realities. And usually what I answer to those people is that the way that propaganda works is that it's always going to be easier for you to see it in other people than it is for you to see it for yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's always good to treat it like a mirror. So if you want to understand why the Israeli society is blind to this, look in what your own countries are doing to be able to understand, and also so you can actually understand and not see this as like this isolated issue that is the problem is with those people who are blind, but as a human issue and a propaganda issue that we actually need to combat, instead of accepting that some people are evil, some people are blind, some people just don't get it. And this is what is happening also in Europe, that we are blind to what's going on in our borders. We're blind to, you know, the effects that colonization had on the world. We're blind to the fact that it's still continuing. And we can move on with our lives because we're within our communities and we don't have to see all the horror and destruction. For us, it's even easier here in Europe because it's across the ocean. So it's not even really possible for us to just go and see it even by accident. But the differences are really, really small, because it doesn't matter at the end of the day if it's across the ocean or if it's 20 minutes by car. At the end of the day, if you decide that this is the other place, that doesn't matter what's happened there, because it's already justified, or it's just messy and it's too complicated, and you know, whatever is happening is probably their fault or mismanaged, then you're already in the same boat at the end of the day. And I think this is what I really tell especially Europeans and Americans as well, when they look at what's going on in Israel, to have the confidence to both put pressure and, you know, not just accept it as a complicated issue and really try to get involved, because I think the European voice especially has a lot of power when it comes to this, because it has been really supporting Israel through a lot of this, like in all ways possible. And at the same time, to not distance yourself from this, to not see this as an external problem that you can look down on, but as something that is present in everywhere, and that we need to work together to end it rather than to see it as an isolated issue, because again, seeing things as isolated issues is what brought us here in the first place. The Zionist movement was kind of formed out of European anti-Semitism. I think mm-hmm. most of us know this, right? And it was supported by a lot of European anti-Semites as a way to get rid of the Jewish problem. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this really speaks to even the concept of nation states, the idea that any group that is present in a nation state that's not its own is automatically a problem, that it's an unnatural state of being, that countries need to have like this homogeneous population that's, you know, of the same population. And for example, coming to Europe, it was really, really interesting to me that a lot of European anti-Semites that I met were basically, they once hated Jews, let's say, and now they reflect this towards the Roma people, which they already did, but now it's more directed towards them because they are seen as still this group that is, you know, without a nation state. Mm-hmm. Or it's directed towards the Palestinians, which are seen as, again, as a group without a nation state of its own. Mm-hmm. That is it's still with the same kind of imagery of a group that is leeching off of the normal nation state that mm-hmm. has, you know, this normal way of life, that has, you know, the dignity of having a country and having, you know, the myths of, you know, civilization. And I think part of also of really undoing all of this and not just repeating the cycle is really also addressing the idea of minorities in general. That there is so much fear in Israeli Jews of becoming a minority again because of this communal consciousness that being a minority was the worst thing, and no matter what, no matter time, 2,000 years, and always being a minority was meant persecution and meant unfreedom and meant exclusion. And this idea that this is the way that minorities are treated, this is the normal way that minorities are treated, is still replicated in Israel to even a group that is not even a minority but is made a minority. And until we really get this idea, get rid of this idea that this is how minorities also should be treated, that we get rid of this idea that a territory belongs to a group of people based on ethnicity and based on tracing back roots, and really deciding whether people belong based on where they were born or whether they have enough sufficient ties, which we also see in immigration processes all over, that you need to prove you have sufficient ties. And this whole process, this whole kind of thinking of citizenship is itself super damaging. And it's gonna still keep being damaging to everyone that's involved. One time you're gonna be in as part of the majority group, but things change and we see that borders change and groups, you know, become countries and then get split. And the whole idea of, you know, the stable civilizations that exist forever, we see that historically this is not the case. And the idea of who we are as a people also change. Here in Europe, I think it's you can really see how much changes there are in the borders of nationality and who's considered part of the nation state, who's considered not part. And I think part of this is also really like within European society as well, to get rid of this idea that minorities are this thing that should be kept, you know, this small minority to make sure that they do not have significant political power, that they have to pass all these tests to prove their belonging. Because again, this kind of fear of being a minority is what causes also groups to be oppressive the minute that they get the chance. And we see this cycle replicating itself.